Jesse Wilkerson and Mimi Pickering, and I'm at Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky. The date is August 5th, 2010. And I always like to start these interviews with getting a sense of a person's childhood, early life history, so where you come from and what your family was like.
Okay, well, I am not a native of Kentucky. I actually grew up in California, in the Bay Area, in a fairly middle class community and family. And so I went to, I was sort of in high school in the 60s, and I would say was fairly influenced by the 60s, sort of with questioning what was going on. I think partly through my youth church program and stuff, we were questioning the Vietnam War, and you know, the whole hippie thing was happening in San Francisco. And and then we also there were sort of leftist students from Stanford coming to our high school, and so there got to be a pretty radical group going. And so I actually was introduced to the women's movement at that time, like late 60s, early 70s, and I don't know which wave of the women's movement that is. But so, you know, very early on as a teenager and young adult, started to think of myself as a feminist and in that perspective. And then I wanted to, when I got out of high school, I wanted to go and live somewhere else or experience other things and not just stay in that environment or stay in California. So although I was not that excited about going to college, but I did end up going to Europe for a while and then going to Antioch College in Ohio. And that's a school that has a program where you, it did exist. You go to school for a couple months and then you go intern somewhere. Mm. I think Antioch kind of invented the notion of the intern, but it was a mandatory. It was part of the degree program. So I actually was there in the fall of 1970 and met a woman who was from West Virginia. And so through her, we went to Charleston. I met some folks working with the Black Lung Association and some other groups. And then they decided they might like to get some Antioch interns, and so came and interviewed some people. I was interested, so I ended up going in January of 71 to be an intern in Charleston, West Virginia. And what they wanted me to do was to, they had been given some video equipment, it was already out of date, but some of the first portable video equipment. And Gibbs Kinderman was who I worked with, and he was really interested in the notion of media and how media could be used, and that it was becoming more affordable and accessible to folks. And he had heard about Apple Shop, so they had been given this equipment donated from somebody, and he wanted to use it to do some training tapes with the Black Lung Association, because they were all about training lay advocates to help miners get their black lung claims, and also kind of organizing the UMW reform movement there. But he'd heard about Apple Shop, so on my first or second week, January of that year, we came down here to Whitesburg and met Bill Richardson, and Apple Shop was pretty young at that time. But so Gibbs came up with an idea of doing a film with Apple Shop to, in part for me to learn filmmaking, to continue on with them in West Virginia, and also there was a community in Southwest Virginia that he thought would be really good to document. So then I started working on a film with Appleshop that ultimately became The Struggle of Coon Branch Mountain. And I went from sort of being in a learning position to kind of directing and editing the film eventually at the end of it. And then I also, so I kind of commuted between Charleston and Whitesburg at that time. And then I also, with some of this video equipment and some other equipment, they connected with George Stoney from New York University, and who was just doing media access stuff with video and cable access. And so we also started a cable program on the cable system in Charleston, where we did kind of community access programming. So that was fun to do. It actually didn't. We did shows like we kind of went to different groups, statewide groups, and had let them do a show, so it wasn't. And then it only showed in Charleston. So I don't know, the audience, the shows, all that didn't really mix. But it mm-hmm. was fun to do, and groups like the West Virginia Welfare Rights Organization did a show, which was great. You know, they acted out being nasty case officers, and then our work was, we did stuff on Black Lung and stuff, and our work there was more state focused than Charleston. But mm-hmm. anyway, that's how I sort of got involved in media work, and involved with Appleshop.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly. I guess that we, when doing The Struggle of Coon Branch Mountain, there had been some, a Vista in particular, who'd been involved with this community, which had been, a lot of their fight had already occurred, where they were fighting to get a road, and so that a school bus would come up on to their mountain community and take their kids, so the kids could go beyond the eighth grade. They could go mm-hmm. to the high school in town. But the school system said the road was too bad, you know, to send up a bus. So they were going to different people trying to get a road and a school and all this. And so this Vista had been involved with them, and I think he had actually gotten fired because he had helped this group, and they'd challenged the all the powers that be. But I think he probably suggested that this one woman, Birdie Powell, would be a good, you know, was really important to the story. And so then eventually she became, in my mind, kind of the storyteller. And
mm-hmm.
and it's a real short film, but I think she's sort of the featured person in that. And, you know, I think it, from that point on, most of my films have really, it's ended up that women are the principal storytellers, and it really has not been a deliberate choice on my part. It's just that, you know, I've found that they really are the community leaders in so many of these struggles,
mm-hmm.
and you know, maybe not acknowledged as that so much, but they are, you know, and they're really these amazing strong women that hold their families together and hold their communities together, and
mm-hmm.
you know, are willing to step up and take the heat and, you know, do all these amazing things.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if your background with feminism and being open to I guess going through like a phase of gender consciousness or
uh-huh.
whatever allowed you to see those women doing like the, you know, primary work or like having
mm-hmm.
key roles. Other filmmakers who maybe didn't
right.
have that same experience. It's just I don't know.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, my involvement in the women's movement, it did start in what was sort of typical of that time of sort of consciousness raising and,
mm-hmm.
you know, women talking about men and, you know, society and being screwed over and this and that and power. But I think it also, I was also involved in, you know, sort of left-wing politics. And so, you know, got a bit of learning about a class analysis. And that was one of the reasons that I was, you know, really interested in going to West Virginia, because such a state, you know, so a poor state with, but also with a sort of a strong middle, working class, labor movement, you know, and union workers. And, so I thought if, you know, if these, all these organizing, the working class ideas are legitimate, West Virginia ought to be a place where,
mm-hmm.
you know, that plays out.
Can you say more about the politics that you, or the political movement you were getting involved in? Because it seems to be a story that we run into a lot of people who were involved in leftist
mm-hmm.
political groups and then moved to this region and started doing organizing
mm-hmm.
work. So could you tell a little bit more about how that played out? So where you started?
Yeah, and I... I was never like, didn't really join any of these groups, but my brother was quite active, who was a year younger than me. And, you know, I was friends and involved and all that. But you know, it was a lot of stuff coming out of the anti-war movement and some of the people coming from, you know, from over in Stanford and organizing in the whole Bay Area. So it kind of evolved to the, eventually there was a group called the Revolutionary Union, I think, the RU, which was active. And I know some of those folks did leave the Bay Area and come to West Virginia as organizers. So I didn't do that exactly, but they were a Marxist, Leninist, Maoist group.
Mm-hmm.
And they later became the Revolutionary Communist Party, the RCP. And so I was never, you know, an official member of any of, but I certainly knew people and participated in some of the, I can't remember what they called them, maybe study groups or something. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and did definitely think that a lot of the philosophy and ideas and sort of anti-capitalist approach made a lot of sense. But I guess that was one of the reasons I was attracted to West Virginia, because you know, because of that,
mm-hmm.
like, if here's people who are, you know, really being exploited and they have, and there is a class consciousness through the mine workers and other unions, and so if this is really a, you know, something that is a reality and could happen in the U.S. it seems like this would be a good, you know, place for organizing.
Mm-hmm.
Although, again, I was not, I have not, I mean, I went to Antioch and in high school did a lot of artwork, and I sort of was majoring in art, so I was, I've never really wanted to be an organizer, but, and one of the things I found in making that first film was, you know, that I found it a really creative activity. You know, I really loved filmmaking and editing and putting it all together, and, you know, found it a way to hopefully in doing that also being able to have something to say or tell stories that needed to be told from the perspective of people who were directly involved. And so I found it, you know, really satisfying
mm-hmm.
way of being creative.
Mm-hmm. When you came to West Virginia and then you started working more in the region, how did that change the politics that you had been learning, or the kind of the political experience you'd been having on the West Coast and at college? How did that compare to what you actually faced when you got here?
Well, I, you know, I actually found that a lot of the, you know, a lot of the people that I interacted with were pretty progressive in lots of ways. You know, they, I mean, they really did have a class analysis that was pretty on target, and for the first, because it was for the first year that I was in the region, I was working a lot with the Black Lung Association, so there were a lot of disabled miners who had really, you know, had been horribly screwed by the system, the companies, and they knew it, and you know, had a pretty good sense of where it came from, and you know, people were, they were religious, but it didn't seem like a different kind of religion then, you know, it was, I mean, there would be some of the most, you know, Pentecostal, really small time churches that with, and the preacher, and those preachers would be part of, be members of the Black Lung Association, and would, you know, deliver a prayer before, at the end of the meeting, and it would just be, you know, an amazing prayer that brought in the situation there in West Virginia, made it very, you know, very real and based in that place, and was kind of a prayer of, you know, unity and solidarity. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a religious person, but you know, I really, you know, I related to that, and it didn't seem in any way in opposition to the organizing work. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I mean, attitudes towards women were, they were traditional in lots of ways, but there were a lot of women involved in the, you know, in the Black Lung movement, a lot of widows, mm-hmm. you know, or wives whose husbands were so disabled they really couldn't participate much. And they were, you know, they were always very, you know, well received, and you know, seemed like they could, you know, participated. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I didn't find it a huge culture shock in some mm-hmm. ways. I mean, I think, you know, what has happened, you know, over the 40 years that I've lived here is I've seen the region both politically and culturally get much more conservative, which is a sad sign. But I mean, about a year ago, I was driving from like here to Charleston, and was in Logan County, West Virginia, and it was Easter time, and you know, then just driving alongside the road, there's like a little pilgrimage of people dragging a cross, you know, and doing the Easter thing. It was like this on the highway, you know, uh-huh. this is not something you would have seen 30 years ago, you know. Just
what do you think has led to those changes?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's symptomatic of, or the same thing that's happened in a lot of the country, but that we've, you know, we've become more conservative. I mean, some of it I think is a reaction to the women's movement, to the gay, lesbian gay movement, you know, to civil rights movement, all these things that there's, you know, there's definitely been backlash, and it's happened both politically and culturally. I also think that, you know, that the, I think at early on, people were, they were Democrats and they voted for Democrats, and now like they're Democrats and they vote for Republicans, mm-hmm. and I think back then they really did feel like the Democrats stood for something and actually delivered things that, you know, made their lives better. And then I think in more recent years, you know, the Democrats have not, for working people, have not visibly done any much more than Republicans have, at least that's easy to see. And you know, the Democrats supported NAFTA, which a lot of working people, you know, really, I mean, did, I mean, all of these world trade things have really, really hurt working people, and maybe the financial industry has profited, but mm-hmm. so my theory, in part, is that, you know, people have turned to God and faith and religion more because they don't see any help anywhere else. And these more conservative politicians who, you know, who prey on that and push in that direction, that, you know, things would be better, or we would go back to where we were, to that good times, if we, you know, if we outlawed immigrants, you know, if we got rid of gay people, if women would go back in the home, you know, all those kinds of things. And when you haven't seen a lot of benefit from the other direction, it's easy to, you know, to fall for that. And religion is really important here, and, you know, been strong in lots of ways. People have lots of faith, which can be a really good thing. But I mean, you know, you have you know, really low to moderate income people also concerned about continuing the so-called death taxes, you know, as if estate taxes are going, you know, as if that's going to have any impact upon them at all. Right. I mean, in fact, it will hurt them if we don't tax those kinds, you know, really right. wealthy people.
Mm-hmm. Have those political shifts affected your own work?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've done one of the things I've done. I've produced documentary films and videos, and then I've also tried to work in media or communication sort of strategies with grassroots groups around policy, more directly around policy issues. And so we were involved with a group called the Kentucky Economic Justice Alliance, which involved Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and Apple Shop and Kentucky Farm Alliance and Kentucky Youth Advocates at one point. And so we have worked, particularly for the last 5 or 6 years, it's not going anymore, but KFTC continues it, but have been working for, you know, fair and adequate tax reform. So we've been, you know, we've really been fighting the public sentiments for a while, and it's a frustrating battle that, you know, just fighting to try to keep state budgets for, you know, for domestic violence centers and, you know, school lunches and on, you know, adequate schools. And it's also fighting against an attitude that government is bad and that government doesn't do anything, and, you know, we should get away from government. So I've seen all those perceptions of the role of government, I've seen that change over the years, and it's Anne Braden talks about it in the film we're doing with her, and she talked about it a lot. This whole, you know, the reverse discrimination thing, which I think is, you know, it's tied into this where, you know, the message has been going out that, you know, we now discriminate against white people, and that, you know, we've given everything to black people and women and immigrants and all of this, and, you know, and we've given that in the form of our government, you know, largesse to all these people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we the poor, hardworking white people are being discriminated against, and, you know, as a rationale to cut taxes and to cut all these programs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so we've continued to fight to try to maintain them or increase them, you know, because...
Sounds like a daunting task.
Yeah. I mean, and in the belief that government, you know, really should represent the people,
mm-hmm.
not the corporations, you know, and that government is the place to level the playing field and, you know, work in the people's interest.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't think it does, and I think it's gotten, you know, worse instead of better.
Mm-hmm. a question along those lines. Oh, because I was just thinking about how it seems, like since you've been in the area for a long time, you would have seen this shift from like war on poverty, where government was involved and it
mm-hmm.
seemed like good resources were coming out of that, to people thinking the government's too big.
Right.
But I wonder what your sense is of the memory, or like how people think about the war on poverty or its legacy. Is that something that ever comes up in your work?
I mean, it comes up. It has come up, at Apple Shop a lot, because, some of our films, like Stranger with a Camera,
mm-hmm.
you know, that Elizabeth did, deals with that, and Strangers and Kin does, and some other Headwater shows. But I think now when you like talking to college age kids or younger, I don't think they know what the war on poverty is or was.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of fading, into the distance.
Mm-hmm.
We've done at Apple Shop, we've been part of discussions about the war on poverty, and it definitely had some negative, people locally, felt negative aspects of it. And, one of the things that really interests me is our images in this country and feelings about poverty. And, every time that there's a film that comes out that looks at the Appalachian region and poverty, there's a scream of outrage, like, why do they focus on us, and why do they do this? And you have mayors and Congress people all
mm-hmm.
criticizing a film when they've never seen it, which I think is interesting. But and most recently, Diane Sawyer did a piece on, called Appalachia's Children or something,
yeah.
which, it was, network TV, but people just say they hate. And yet, she was filming real stuff, like, the really bad situation with tooth decay,
mm-hmm.
and people, kids drinking all this pop and all this kind of stuff. She failed to put any kind of analysis on it,
mm-hmm.
economic analysis, that people don't have drinking water, that they can
mm-hmm.
don't have safe drinking water, so you give the kid pop, that's cheaper than buying water or easier.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I think the war on poverty probably brought the region into the limelight, at least in, the past century or in people's memories, more than previous times it was brought up. But and left with a lot of people this sort of feeling of a stereotype or stigma of being poor, and that I think continues, and people are really sensitive about any portrayals of any of the poverty in the region. And I think it's in large part because in the country as a whole, we have this just really, negative attitude towards poor people and poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's changed. We have a big storm
mm-hmm.
over... I think it might have been different in the 30s when, there was more class organizing and I always get the sense that in Europe there's more of a pride of being from, being working class or,
mm-hmm.
A sense of being poor, having some dignity. But here it just seems it's been stripped of all dignity, and it's a blame the victim kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's really detrimental in this region because it's hard then to have a real discussion or exploration of poverty and, you know, why people are poor and sort of the, you know, the systemic reasons for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, kind of a lingering effect of the war on poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it suits a lot of interests, you know, to have this defensive reaction to any depiction of poverty, because then, you know, it gets just dismissed and you know, there's, I mean, you think about the, you know, the era of John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, when the press came into the region and they showed people living in, you know, real, I mean, dire circumstances and, you know, starving, and the reaction of the populace, I think, and the politicians was to provide help. And
mm-hmm.
then nowadays you do some, you know, Diane Sawyer does a piece and it shows, you know, shows people in pretty dire circumstances and, you know, nothing happens and it's just dismissed. And
mm-hmm.
people want to say, no, that's not true. And they certainly want to say, that's not me. You know, I'm not.
Yeah. Do you think something's changed too with the imagery or and the type of poverty they're showing? I mean, because one thing I've been thinking about is how in the 80s there's this whole, like, the welfare queen, and
mm-hmm.
it's women, and then it is also true that more and more women are falling into poverty
mm-hmm.
without support, and it's children, and it is definitely gets gendered.
Right.
A lot of people would say. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that, like how those images or ideas of poverty have changed. And I saw that Diane Sawyer piece.
Uh-huh.
And one thing that, I mean, I think there's a way that the images with Kennedy and Johnson, like, it's poor people, but there's something, I think, like, people could romanticize it in a way, because it's shacks and it's people in overalls and it's sort of quaint in its own way,
right?
And then the Diane Sawyer piece, you have like meth
right.
addicts and trailers and people burning tires, and it's a different. It looks different, at least the way it's being shown
yeah.
on TV.
Maybe it's the difference between color and black and white.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are. I mean, there are, I mean, in the same way that we have not conquered racism in this country, and, you know, probably, I mean, that's the kind of thing you never completely can, but, you know, by no means has the women's movement achieved its, you know, its end goals, and, you know, there's definitely a lot of hostility and resentment towards women, and I think, and welfare definitely becomes a flashpoint for that, you know, that these women are, well, people don't, again, I think it's, a lot of it is a lack of understanding of the reality of the situation, and a lot of, you know, myths about it that, you know, that, I mean, the reality is that I think, And I was doing a piece on welfare reform and did some short pieces. It was really, you know, interesting, of women who were on public assistance and then going to the community college, you know, and who had recognized they needed to get their GEDs and then get, you know, at least an associate's degree if they were going to get any, you know, get a job. And so, you know, here they were trying to better themselves, and as they would say, we're trying to become taxpayers, you know, we're trying to be, you know, contribute. And that was right when the Welfare Reform Act of 96 went through, and it made it much harder for anyone to go to school
mm-hmm.
and get public assistance. You know, it's just like punitive or something, you know, so it's
mm-hmm.
not a, it is not a program designed to help people get on their feet. It's almost
mm-hmm.
you know, to undercut them. But I do think it is, in, you know, it is primarily women and children who benefit from that program, and they're not held in high esteem, you know, in our society. And then they're looked on as that poverty is their doing, and so they don't deserve these benefits. And there are actually benefits, like the, you know, the dollar amount hasn't changed in 20 years or something, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing this recently, this debate over unemployment insurance.
Yeah.
As if, you know, again, that was like some welfare giveaway, and
right, people wouldn't want the job anymore.
Yeah, they won't look for a job if they're getting unemployment, you know.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know if that is a lack of a sense of reality on the part of people. I mean, clearly it is for some people who fall for that. For the politicians, of course, they know. They're just, it's just a cynical ploy.
Mm-hmm. Well, so but how have you...
And you know, with welfare, that was an area in the region where there was a really strong women-led movement, kind of in the time of the welfare rights, the whole national,
mm-hmm.
you know, movement. It's one that has kind of died down. And actually with KFTC, we did work on welfare reform and all those issues, and had some good organizing going on with women. And then what happened was it got harder and harder for women to go to college, and they also had to work all these hours either voluntarily or, well, to get their check. So they were, and so they really, it was kind of a masterful thing, because they no longer had any time to be involved in any organizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between going to school and then working
mm-hmm.
their 30 hours a week and raising children, you know, they couldn't go to KFTC meetings or, you know, march on Frankfurt or anything like that.
Or rest.
Yeah, right. Or sleep, you know.
Yeah. So given the issues you've addressed that women have faced here, has your sense of the women's movement changed over time? You know, the way you define it, or the goals, like what you see as the primary goals?
Yeah, well, I guess that my, you know, starting pretty early, my sense of the women's movement, you know, did really involve the economic issues were, you know, more important than some of the, or the issues facing, you know, working and poor women were really at the heart of it, and where the emphasis should be. And, you know, I've been a little disdainful of, you know, the Ms. crowd, kind of, or, you know, and even I'm very pro-abortion, pro-choice, but have not been, you know, have thought some of those organizations were, you know, really catering to, you know, upper middle class white women. And I'm probably unfair in that, you know, I just get their stuff in the mail, but have, you know, haven't really seen that as a place to move forward the issues that much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah. I mean, with this project, we're really trying to think about what the women's movement looks like in the South.
Uh-huh.
Getting away from this standard narrative that, I mean, I think from that middle class sort of Ms.
Right.
crowd narrative. So I wonder if you have, it's really,
it's not a new
store about that.
I wish my windows weren't open at home, but
oh,
I knew I should have closed them, but yeah, it'll survive. I mean, one thing that I have, I mean, I've experienced both in being involved in, you know, a citizens group like KFTC, and then also in my media work, is that I think in the region, most of the grassroots struggles around various issues have been led by women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, they really, women are kind of at the heart of communities and are the, you know, the most likely to stand up and fight for, you know, their families and their community. And I think, you know, some of the people you mentioned earlier, you know, Bumpus Cove
mm-hmm.
was certainly that case. That was the case, and just, you know, time after time,
mm-hmm.
You know, they've been these sort of unsung leaders, and they do not say, well, you know, I'm a feminist, or
mm-hmm.
I'm the, or this is the woman's movement, but, you know, by their actions and you know, willingness to fight and determination, you know, I think they really are. And another interesting thing has been to see women who got involved in some of these struggles because, you know, their community was threatened with toxic chemicals, or, you know, or building of a coal-fired plant, or, you know, whatever it was, that they're to see their growth in that process,
mm-hmm.
that you know, they may not win the fight, but there's so often a kind of a growing realization of their value and their self-worth, and, you know, what they can do, and, you know, kind of a real, they had that strength there but maybe didn't realize it, and
mm-hmm.
and that's been really interesting to see. And it's, you know, it's great to see these women emerging as more and more leaders. And the, you know, what also has tend to happen in a lot of cases is their relationships have fallen apart,
mm-hmm.
which I think, you know, maybe as the women become more self-assertive or, you know, more engaged with outside communities, some of the husbands are not too happy with that.
Mm-hmm. So
it's just not the little woman I married who's there to feed me dinner every night.
Yeah. I wonder if there's ever resentment over that happening, though. I mean, if it's a... This came up in another interview when someone mentioned that women in this particular group would not say they were they would say they were for women's rights, but they wouldn't
mm-hmm.
say they were feminists because they didn't want to be perceived as anti-man, because they really liked having a husband and
right.
wanted a needed a husband for me, because they just wanted a husband and for economic reasons, and just believed in having a traditional family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to think about getting involved and then, you know, losing a husband
mm-hmm.
or support system, or, like, you know, I'm sure it's really complicated.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that it goes to messaging again, you know, like, feminist is a dirty word. Well, you know, why should that, I mean, it means man hater and, you
mm-hmm.
know, abortionist and, you know, all of these things that have just, and it's so that's, you know, I think women do shy away from that, from being, you know, from saying they're feminists, and, you know, it's too bad that, you know, it's always too bad when a label, I mean, labels are labels and they're not great, but a word like that can, you know, becomes distorted or
mm-hmm.
gets taken out of, you know, its proper place.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, you know, the film, I did a film on Hazel Dickens, who's a, you know, a wonderful working class singer songwriter, and her songs that she writes to me are just the epitome of, you know, working class feminism. I just think they describe the lives of you know, so many women and usually have a pretty ass kicking kind of end, like working class, you know, working girl blues, and, you know, like, I'm like, take this job and shove it kind of thing. But, you know, in talking to Hazel and sort of interviewing her, she definitely didn't want to be, you know, labeled a feminist. But her, you know, her whole lifestyle of, she's not married now, and she's, you know, she lives by herself. She's very independent. She's a very much makes up her own mind and, you know, handles her own career and all of those things. And, you know, and her art, I mean, she is, in my mind, in every way. But to her, that label means something else that she's not comfortable with.
Hmm.
And I think that's, you know, really sad that we've come to that. And I think that's true of, you know, a lot of Southern women, women
mm-hmm.
from the country, from rural areas, that mm-hmm. they are, they just don't, you know, that label doesn't feel right, and there's no other, there isn't another term, you know, or way to describe themselves in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is what we're coming up against almost in every, even women who maybe once did identify as feminists
uh-huh.
will sort of back away from it. And I think it just, culture wars, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's
the name.
Right.
The name meant, came to mean something else.
Right. There was another project I worked on recently with Angie DeBord, who's a storyteller and playwright, and we interviewed a bunch of women in a community right over the mountain here in Cowan, and the idea was to just sit around and tell stories and about growing up with a group of women who were sort of middle-aged, 40s and 50s, and then eventually make a play out of it. And we ended up with a slightly older group, but they were great, and of course they knew each other, but their stories of their mothers were just amazing. You know, they almost every woman in the group came from a family of like anywhere from 8 to 15 children. And I mean, these were not ancient women, you know, they're
yeah.
maybe, you know, from 45 to 65. And, you know, they're talking about their mother, the work they did, you know, the cleaning and washing without running water, and, you know, and raising the garden to put food on the table, and, you know, all of that. So that I guess you would call that a very traditional life. But in my mind, you know, it's, it's about as, and in some ways, as much about feministism,
mm-hmm.
as, you know, anything. It's just was not recognized as such.
It's not the 1950s housewife.
Right, exactly, not at all. And
yeah.
these were 1950s and 60s, you know,
yeah.
here, which was a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure, you know, the women, they, you know, they stepped back for their, when they did have husbands, you know, there, a lot of the men died, were killed in the mines or whatever, but, you know, they deferred to them, but, and culturally, you know, that would be expected, but it, you know, it didn't mean who really is the power in the house, you know, or
mm-hmm.
who's the one who's keeping it all together, or making it, you know, making this family grow.
Right. Well, I have one more question.
Okay.
Sort of wrap up, but I wonder if you could say a little bit about the most important moments in your long history here at Apple Shop. Like, what moments really stand out to you? Is it the ones you're really proudest of?
Well, I think that the things I'm proudest of are the media work that I've done, and the, you know, the people stories that in that work, and getting that out, and, you know, having it as kind of a lasting piece of work that's out there, and then getting you know, getting responses that say it's made a difference
mm-hmm.
to them. I actually, with the Buffalo Creek flood film I did, I got a letter a number of years ago from a University of Hawaii law school class, and said they'd watched the film in class, and they wrote about how much it meant to them, and, you know, that they would dedicate their careers to making sure that nothing like that ever happened. And
mm-hmm.
and then they wrote another letter to the people of Buffalo Creek, and they asked me to send that to them, and they, you know, wrote about how, you know, brave and strong and courageous they were, and they could see their, you know, dedication to their community and their place, and that
mm-hmm.
was like, you know, you don't get that stuff written down very much,
right.
But that was really you know, rewarding for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're, you know, as the technology is changing, it's making it easier to, you know, work with people to have them really tell their own stories and be able to do it, you know, more themselves, just with some facilitating and guidance, and that's very satisfying. I think this, I'm working on these kind of digital storytelling that's real low tech kind of things, but really, really powerful stories can be made. So I think there's so many stories of, you know, amazing people standing up and fighting for their families and their communities, and
mm-hmm.
it's just it's a real opportunity to be able to get those out in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything you would like to add or anything else you would like to cover before we end?
I don't think so. You know, I definitely consider myself a feminist and have tried to bring those sort of principles into, you know, my relationships at work and with other people and in, you know, presenting women in my stories, you know, as well as I could. So that's about it.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.